I heard him lecture in Venice. It'll be more than 20 years ago now. I was your age, I suppose. He spoke about proportion. Proportion in building, in music, in paintings, in justice, in the Commonwealth, the state. About how right should be balanced. The power of a prince and his subjects. How the wealthy citizen should keep his books straight and say his prayers and serve the poor. He spoke about how a printed page should look, how a law should read, or a face, what makes it beautiful. Will you tell me in this book? Thomas Avery glances up again at the Queen of Sheba. I suppose they knew who made the tapestry. How is Yenica? The boy turns the leaves with reverent fingers. It is a beautiful book. Your friends in Venice must admire you very much. So, Yenica is no more, he thinks. She is dead, or she's in love with someone else. Sometimes, he says, my friends in Italy send me new poems. But I think all the poems are in here. Not that a page of figures is a verse, but anything that is precise is beautiful. Anything that balances in all its parts. Anything that is proportionate. Do you think so? He wonders at the power Sheba has to draw the boy's eyes. It is impossible he should have seen Anselma, ever met her, heard of her. I told Henry about her, he thinks. One of those afternoons when I told my king a little, and he told me a lot. How he shakes with desire when he thinks of Anne. How he has tried other women, tried them as an expedient to take the edge off lust, so that he can think and talk and act as a reasoning man. But how he has failed with them. A strange admission, but he thinks it justifies him. He thinks it verifies the rightness of his pursuit. For I chase but one hind, he says, one strange deer, timid and wild. And she leads me off the path that other men have trod, and by myself into the depths of the wood. Now, he says, we will put this book on your desk, so that you can be consoled by it when nothing seems to add up at all. He has great hopes of Thomas Avery. It's easy to employ some child who will total the columns and push them under your nose, get them initialed and then lock them in a chest. But what's the point of that? The page of an accounts book is there for your use, like a love poem. It's not there for you to nod and then dismiss it. It's there to open your heart to possibility. It's like the scriptures. It's there for you to think about and initiate action. Love your neighbour. Study the market. Increase the spread of benevolence. Bring in better figures next year. The date of James Baynham's execution is fixed for the 30th of April. He cannot go to the king, not with any hope of a pardon. Long ago, Henry was given the title of Defender of the Faith. He is keen to show he deserves it still. At Smithfield, in the stand put up for the dignitaries, he meets the Venetian ambassador, Carlo Capello. They exchange a bow. In what capacity are you here, Cromwell? As a friend of this heretic, or by virtue of your position? In fact, what is your position? The devil alone knows. And I am sure he will tell your excellency when you next have a private talk. Wrapped in his sheet of flames, the dying man calls out, "The Lord forgive Sir Thomas More." On the 15th of May, the bishops sign a document of submission to the king. They will not make new church legislation without the king's license, and will submit all existing laws to a review by a commission which will include laymen, members of parliament and the king's appointees. They will not meet in convocation without the king's permission. Next day, he stands in a gallery at Whitehall, which looks down on an inner court, a garden where the king waits, and the Duke of Norfolk busies to and fro. Anne is in the gallery beside him. She's wearing a dark red gown of figured damask, so heavy that her tiny white shoulders seem to droop inside it. Sometimes, in a kind of fellowship of the imagination, he imagines resting his hand upon her shoulder and following with his thumb the scooped hollow between her collarbone and her throat. Imagines with his forefinger tracking the line of her breast as it swells above her bodice, as a child follows a line of print. She turns her head and half smiles. Here he comes. He's not wearing the Lord Chancellor's chain. What can he have done with it? Thomas More looks round-shouldered and despondent. Norfolk looks tense. My uncle has been trying to arrange this for months, Anne says. But the king will not be brought to it. He doesn't want to lose More. He wants to please everybody. You know how it is.
He knew Thomas More when he was young.
When I was young, I knew sin.
They turn and smile at each other.
Look now, Anne says. Do you suppose that is the seal of England, that he's got in that leather bag?
When Wolsey gave up the great seal, he dragged out the process for 2 days, but now the king, in the private paradise below, is waiting with open hand.
So who now? Anne says. Last night he said, my Lord Chancellors are nothing but grief to me. Perhaps I shall do without one.
The lawyers will not like that. Somebody must rule the courts.
Then who do you say?
Put it in his mind to appoint Mr. Speaker. Audley will do an honest job. Let the king try him in the role, pro tem, if he will. And then if he does not like him, he need not confirm it. But I think he will like him. Audley is a good lawyer, and he is his own man. But he understands how to be useful. And he understands me, I think.
To think that someone does. Shall we go down?
You cannot resist it.
No more can you.
They go down the inner staircase. Anne places her fingertips lightly on his arm. In the garden below, nightingales are hung in cages. Struck mute, they huddle against the sunlight. A fountain pit-patters into a basin. A scent of thyme rises from the herb beds. From inside the palace, an unseen someone laughs. The sound is cut off, as if a door had closed. He stoops and picks a sprig of the herb, bruises its scent into his palm. It takes him to another place, far from here. More makes his bow to Anne. She barely nods. She curtsies deeply to Henry, and arranges herself by his side, her eyes on the ground. Henry clutches her wrist. He wants to tell her something, or just be alone with her.
Sir Thomas.
He offers his hand. More turns away. Then he thinks better of it. He turns back and takes it. His fingertips are ashy cold.
What will you do now?
Write, pray.
My recommendation will be write only a little and pray a lot.
Now, is that a threat? More is smiling.
It may be.
My turn, don't you think?
When the king saw Anne, his face had lit up. His heart is ardent. In his counsellor's hand, it burns to the touch.
He catches Gardiner at Westminster, in one of those smoky back courts where the sunlight never reaches.
My Lord Bishop.
Gardiner draws together his beetle brows.
Lady Anne has asked me to think about a country house for her.
What is that to me?
Let me unfold to you, he says, the way my thoughts proceed. It should be somewhere near the river, convenient for Hampton Court, and for her barge to Whitehall and Greenwich. Somewhere in good repair, as she has no patience, she will not wait. Somewhere with pretty gardens, well established. Then I think, what about Stephen's manor at Hanworth, that the king leased him when he became Master Secretary?
Even in the dim light, he can see the thoughts chasing each other through Stephen's brain. Oh, my moat and my little bridges, my rose gardens and my strawberry beds, my herb garden, my beehives, my ponds and orchard. Oh, my Italianate terracotta medallions, my intarsia, my gilding, my galleries, my seashell fountain, my deer park.
It would be graceful in you to offer her the lease before it becomes a royal command. A good deed to set against the bishop's stubbornness.
Oh, come on, Stephen. You have other houses. It isn't as if you'll be sleeping under a haystack.
If I were,
the bishop says. I should expect one of your boys along with a ratting dog to dig me out of my dreams. Gardiner's rodent pulses jump. His wet black eyes gleam. He is squeaking inside with indignation and stifled fury. But part of him may be relieved, when he thinks about it, that the bill has come in so early, and that he can meet its terms. Gardiner is still Master Secretary, but he, Cromwell, now sees the King almost every day. If Henry wants advice, he can give it, or if the subject is outside his remit, he will find someone else who can. If the King has a complaint, he will say, "Leave it with me, if by your royal favour I may proceed." If the King is in a good humour, he is ready to laugh, and if the King is miserable, he is gentle and careful with him. The King has begun a course of dissimulation, which the Spanish ambassador, sharp-eyed as ever, has not failed to notice. "He sees you in private, not in his presence chamber," he says. "He prefers if his nobles do not know how often he consults with you. If you were a smaller man, you could be brought in and out in a laundry basket. As it is, I think those so spiteful privy chamber gentlemen cannot fail to tell their friends, who will mutter at your success and circulate slanders against you and plot to bring you down." The ambassador smiles and says, "If I may proffer an image which will appeal to you, do I hit the nail on the head?" In a letter from Chapuis to the Emperor, one which happens to go by way of Mr. Risley, he learns of his own character. Cormy reads it out to him. "He says your antecedents are obscure, your youth reckless and wild, that you are a heretic of long standing, a disgrace to the office of counsellor, but personally he finds you a man of good cheer, liberal, open-handed, gracious." I knew he liked me. I should ask him for a job. "He says that the way you got into the King's confidence, you promised you would make him the richest king England has ever had." He smiles. Late in May, two fish of prodigal size are caught in the Thames, or rather they are washed up, dying on the muddy shore. "Am I expected to do something about it?" he says when Joanne brings the news in. "No," she says. "At least I don't think so. It's important, isn't it? It's an omen, that's all." In late July, he has a letter from Cranmer in Nuremberg. Before this, he has written from the Low Countries, asking for advice on his commercial negotiations with the Emperor, matters in which he feels out of his depth. From towns along the Rhine, he has written hopefully that the Emperor must come to an accommodation with the Lutheran princes, as he needs their help against the Turks on the frontier. He writes of how he struggles to become an adept in England's usual diplomatic game, proffering the King of England's friendship, dangling promises of English gold, while actually failing to provide any. But this letter is different. It is dictated, written in a clerk's hand. It talks of the workings of the Holy Spirit in the heart. Rafe reads it out to him, and points out, down at the bottom, and running up the left margin, a few words in Cranmer's own script. Something has occurred. Not to be trusted to a letter. It may make a stir. Some would say I have been rash. I shall need your advice. Keep this secret. "Well," Rafe says, "let us run up and down cheap. Thomas Cranmer has a secret. We don't know what it is." A week later, Hans turns up at Austin Friars. He has rented a house in Maiden Lane and is staying at the Steelyard while it is fixed up for him. "Let me see your new picture, Thomas," he says, walking in. He stands before it, folds his arms, steps back a pace. "You know these people? The likeness is good." Two Italian bankers, confederates, looking towards the viewer but longing to exchange glances, one in silks, one in fur, a vase of carnations, an astrolabe, a goldfinch, a glass through which the sand has half run, through an arched window a ship rigged with silk, its sails translucent, drifting in a mirror sea. Hans turns away, pleased. "How does he get that expression in the eye, so hard yet so sly?" "How is Elspeth?" "Fat, sad."
Is it surprising? You go home, give her a child, come away again.
I don't reckon to be a good husband. I just send the money home.
How long will you stay with us? Hans grunts, downs his cup of wine, and talks about what he's left behind. Talk about Basel, about the Swiss cantons and cities. Riots and pitched battles. Images, not images. Statues, not statues. It is the body of God, it is not the body of God. It is sort of the body of God. It is his blood, it is not his blood. Priests may marry, they may not. There are seven sacraments, there are three. The crucifix, we creep to on our knees and reverence with our lips. Or the crucifix, we chop it up and burn it in the public square.
I am no Pope lover, but I get tired of it. Erasmus has run off to Freiburg to the papists, and now I have run off to you and Junker Heinrich. That's what Luther calls your king. His disgrace, the King of England.
He wipes his mouth.
All I ask is to do some good work and be paid for it. And I prefer not to have my efforts wiped out by some sectary with a pail of whitewash.
You came here looking for peace and ease? He shakes his head. Too late.
I was just going over London Bridge, and I saw someone had attacked the Madonna's statue. Knocked off the baby's head.
That was done a while back. It would be that devil Cranmer. You know what he is when he's taken a drink. Hans grins.
You miss him. Who'd have thought you would be friends?
Old Warham is not well. If he dies this summer, Lady Anne will ask for Canterbury for my friend.
Hans is surprised.
Not Gardiner.
He's spoiled his chance with the king.
He is his own worst enemy.
I wouldn't say that.
Hans laughs.
It would be a great promotion for Dr. Cranmer.
He will not want it, not he. So much pomp. He likes his books. He will take it. It will be his duty. The best of us are forced against the grain.
What, you?
It is against the grain to have your old patron come and threaten me in my own house and take it quietly, as I do. Have you been to Chelsea?
Yes. They are a sad household.
It was given out that he was resigning on grounds of ill health, so as not to embarrass anybody.
He says he has a pain here.
Hans rubs his chest.
And it comes on him when he starts to write. But the others look well enough. The family on the wall.
You need not go to Chelsea for commissions now. The king has me at work at the tower. We are restoring the fortifications. He has builders and painters and gilders in. We are stripping out the old royal apartments and making something finer. And I am going to build a new lodging for the queen. In this country, you see, the kings and queens light the tower the night before they are crowned. When Anne's day comes, there'll be plenty of work for you. There'll be pageants to design, banquets. And the city will be ordering gold and silver plate to present to the king. Talk to the Hansa merchants. They will want to make a show. Get them planning. Secure yourself the work before half the craftsmen in Europe are here.
Is she to have new jewels?
She is to have Catherine's. He has not lost all sense.
I would like to paint her. Anna Bolena.
I don't know. She may not want to be studied.
They say she is not beautiful.
No, perhaps she is not. You would not choose her as a model for a primavera, or a statue of the Virgin, or a figure of peace.
What then? Eve? Medusa?
Hans laughs.
Don't answer.
She has great presence, esprit. You may not be able to put it in a painting.
I see. You think I am limited.
Some subjects resist you, I feel sure. Richard comes in.
Francis Bryan is here.
Lady Anne's cousin. He stands up.
You must go to Whitehall. Lady Anne is breaking up the furniture and smashing the mirrors.
He swears under his breath. Take Master Holbein in to dinner.
Francis Bryan is laughing so hard that his horse twitches under him, uneasy, and skitters sideways, to the danger of passers-by. By the time they get to Whitehall, he has pieced this story together. Anne has just heard that Harry Percy's wife, Mary Talbot, is preparing to petition Parliament for a divorce. For 2 years, she says, her husband has not shared her bed, and when finally she asked him why, he said he could not carry on a pretense any longer. They were not really married, and never had been, since he was married to Anne Boleyn. "My lady is enraged," Brian says. His eye patch, sewn with jewels, winks as he giggles. "She says Harry Percy will spoil everything for her. She cannot decide between striking him dead with one blow of a sword or teasing him apart over 40 days of public torture like they do in Italy. Those stories are much exaggerated." He has never witnessed or quite believed in Lady Anne's uncontrolled outbursts of temper. When he is admitted, she is pacing, her hands clasped, and she looks small and tense, as if someone has knitted her and drawn the stitches too tight. 3 ladies, Jane Rochford, Mary Shelton, Mary Boleyn, are following her with their eyes. A small carpet, which perhaps ought to be on the wall, is crumpled on the floor. Jane Rochford says, "We have swept up the broken glass." Sir Thomas Boleyn, Monseigneur, sits at a table, a heap of papers before him. George sits by him on a stool. George has his head in his hands. His sleeves are only medium-puffed. The Duke of Norfolk is staring into the hearth, where a fire is laid but not lit, perhaps attempting through the power of his gaze to make the kindling spark. "Shut the door, Francis," George says, "and don't let anybody else in." He's the only person in the room who is not a Howard. "I suggest we pack Anne's bags and send her down to Kent," Jane Rochford says. "The King's anger, once roused," George says. "Say no more, or I may strike you." "It is my honest advice." Jane Rochford, God protect her, is one of those women who doesn't know when to stop. "Master Cromwell, the King has indicated there must be an inquiry. It must come before the council. It cannot be fudged this time. Harry Percy will give testimony unimpeded. The King cannot do all he has done and all he means to do for a woman who is concealing a secret marriage." "I wish I could divorce you," George says. "I wish you had a pre-contract. But Jesus, no chance of that. The fields were black with men running in the other direction." Monseigneur holds up a hand. "Please." Mary Boleyn says, "What is the use of calling in Master Cromwell and not telling him what has already occurred? The King has already spoken to my lady's sister." "I deny everything," Anne says. It is as if the King is standing before her.
"Good," he says, "good."
"That the Earl spoke to me of love, I allow. He wrote me verse, and I, being then a young girl and thinking no harm of it..."
He almost laughs.
"Verse? Harry Percy? Do you still have it?"
"No, of course not. Nothing written."
"That makes it easier," he says gently. "And of course, there was no promise or contract or even talk of them."
"And," Mary says, "no consummation of any kind. There could not be. My sister is a notorious virgin."
"And how was the King? Was he..."
"He walked out of the room," Mary says, "and left her standing."
Monseigneur looks up. He clears his throat.
"In this exigency, there are a variety and number of approaches, it seems to me, that one might..."
Norfolk explodes. He pounds up and down on the floor like Satan in a Corpus Christi play.
"Oh, by the thrice beshitten shroud of Lazarus! While you are selecting an approach, my lord, while you are taking a view, your lady daughter is slandered up and down the country, the King's mind is poisoned, and this family's fortune is unmaking before your eyes."
"Harry Percy," George says. He holds up his hands. "Listen, will you let me speak? As I understand it, Harry Percy was persuaded once to forget his claims, so if he was fixed once..."
"Yes," Anne says.
"But the Cardinal fixed him, and most unfortunately the Cardinal is dead."
There is a silence sweet as music. He looks, smiling at Anne, at Monseigneur, at Norfolk. If life is a chain of gold, sometimes God hangs a charm on it. To prolong the moment, he crosses the room and picks up the fallen hanging. Narrow loom, indigo ground, asymmetrical knot. Isfahan? Small animals march stiffly across it, weaving through knots of flowers. Look, he says. Do you know what these are? Peacocks. Mary Shelton comes to peer over his shoulder.
What are those snake things with legs?
Scorpions.
Mother Mary, do they not bite?
Sting, he says. Lady Anne, if the Pope cannot stop you becoming queen, and I do not think he can, Harry Percy should not be in your way.
So shift him out of it, Norfolk says.
I can see why it would not be a good idea for you as a family.
Do it, Norfolk says. Beat his skull in.
Figuratively, he says, my lord. Anne sits down. Her face is turned away from the women. Her little hands are drawn into fists. Monseigneur shuffles his papers. George, lost in thought, takes off his cap and plays with its jeweled pin, testing the point against the pad of his forefinger. He has rolled the hanging up, and he presents it gently to Mary Shelton.
Thank you, she whispers,
blushing as if he had proposed something intimate. George squeaks. He has succeeded in pricking himself. Uncle Norfolk says bitterly,
You fool of a boy!
Francis Bryan follows him out. Please feel you can leave me now, Sir Francis. I thought I would go with you. I want to learn what you do. He checks his stride, slaps his hand flat into Bryan's chest, spins him sideways, and he hears the thud of his skull against the wall. In a hurry, he says. Someone calls his name. Master Risley rounds a corner.
Sign of Mark and the Lion, 5 minutes' walk.
Cormie has had men following Harry Percy since he came to London. His concern has been that Anne's ill-wishers at court, the Duke of Suffolk and his wife, and those dreamers who believe Catherine will come back, have been meeting with the Earl and encouraging him in a view of the past that would be useful from their point of view. But seemingly no meetings have occurred, unless they are held in bathhouses on the Surrey bank. Cormie turns sharply down an alley, and they emerge into a dirty inn-yard. He looks around. 2 hours with a broom and a willing heart, and you can make it respectable. Mr. Risley's handsome red-gold head shines like a beacon. St. Mark, creaking above his head, is tonsured like a monk. The lion is small and blue and has a smiling face. Cormie touches his arm.
In there.
They are about to duck into a side door, when from above there is a shrill whistle. 2 women lean out of a window, and with a whoop and a giggle flop their bare breasts over the sill.
Jeez you, he says. More Howard ladies.
Inside, Mark and the lion, various men in Percy livery, are slumped over tables and lying under them. The Earl of Northumberland is drinking in a private room. It would be private, except there is a serving hatch through which faces keep leering. The Earl sees him.
Oh, I was half expecting you.
Tense, he runs his hands through his cropped hair, and it stands up in bristles all over his head. He, Cromwell, goes to the hatch, holds up 1 finger to the spectators, and slams it in their face. But he is soft-voiced as ever when he sits down with the boy and says, Now, my lord, what is to be done here? How can I help you? You say you can't live with your wife, but she is as lovely a lady as any in this kingdom. If she has faults, I never heard of them. So why can you not agree? But Harry Percy is not here to be handled like a timid falcon. He is here to shout and weep.
If I could not agree with her on our wedding day, how can I agree now? She hates me because she knows we are not properly married. Why has only the king a conscience in the matter? Why not I? If he doubts his marriage, he shouts about it to the whole of Christendom. but when I doubt mine, he sends the lowest man in his employ to sweet-talk me and tell me to go back home and make the best of it. Mary Talbot knows I was pledged to Anne. She knows where my heart lies and always will. I told the truth before. I said we made a compact before witnesses, and therefore neither of us was free. I swore it, and the Cardinal bullied me out of it. My father said he would strike me out of his line, but my father is dead, and I am not afraid to speak the truth any more. Henry may be king, but he's stealing another man's wife. Anne Boleyn is rightfully my wife. And how will he stand on the day of judgment when he comes before God naked and stripped of his retinue? He hears him out. The slide and tumble into incoherence. True love, pledges. Swore she would give her body to me. Allowed me such freedom as only a betrothed woman would allow. And my lord,